I tried to invite the dead back to my home. My father, my mother, the neighbors, say to them, "Dear dead, please sit down, have a cup of coffee. We need to talk about many things that we have never discussed in front of the children."
That's Amos Oz, talking about his memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness. Oz is widely regarded as Israel's leading novelist. He's also politically active, a prominent advocate of a two-state solution in the Middle East. You might say his life has been a fusion of the literary and the political. His father was obsessed with Israeli politics. His parents were also bookish people, European émigrés, steeped in the classics. Steve Paulson asked Amos Oz to read a bit from his memoir.
Books filled our home. My father could read 16 or 17 languages and could speak 11, all with a Russian accent. My mother spoke 4 or 5 languages and read 7 or 8. They conversed in Russian or Polish when they did not want me to understand, which was most of the time. When my mother referred to a stallion in Hebrew, in my hearing, my father rebuked her furiously in Russian. Что с тобой? Видишь мальчик рядом с нами? What's the matter with you? You can't see that the boy is right here? Out of cultural considerations, they mostly read books in German and English, and presumably they dreamt their dreams in Yiddish. But the only language they taught me was Hebrew. Maybe they feared that a knowledge of a language would expose me to the blandishments of Europe, that wonderful, murderous continent.
Ah, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
What did they mean by that wonderful, murderous continent?
Well, A Tale of Love and Darkness is a tale, among other things, of the unrequited love of my families to Europe. My father, my mother, their ancestors, they were Europeans at a time when no one else in the whole of Europe was a European. Everyone was Norwegian or Italian or just an Albanian patriot. The Jews were Europeans, for which they were labeled cosmopolitans, ruthless intellectuals, parasites. They loved Europe, which never loved them back. They were polyglots. They loved the histories, the cultures, the heritages, the landscapes. Above all, the music. But this was a one-sided love, hard to conceive today when everybody is a European and those who are not yet European are waiting in line to become European.
So they loved this whole culture, everything about it, but so many Europeans hated Jews. They had to leave then.
Well, they were forced to leave. They were kicked out, and they were kicked out and had to opt for Jerusalem, not for a Zionist zeal or for some colonialist ambitions, but because all other doors slammed at their faces in the 1930s. There was no other place in the world they could go.
They couldn't go to America? They couldn't go to England?
My grandfather applied in 1931 when anti-Semitism in Poland became unbearable for French citizenship. He was turned down. He tried to become Scandinavian. They said no. He applied the American consulate. They said, yes, but you have to wait 17 years in line. He, as his family, had no 17 years to wait in 1931. So Jerusalem, Palestine was a life raft. So they tried to build a little Europe in the middle of Jerusalem. This was the tragic comedy of my childhood. They tried to build a tiny little replica of Europe while declaring that they are angry with Europe and they are insulted by Europe.
Well, it's fascinating reading your account of this because you grew up in a very bookish family, a bookish culture. Your parents, your grandparents were scholars. They were intellectuals. They were passionate about politics and they would argue and talk all the time. But all of this was in Jerusalem, and they sort of seemed a little out of place there.
Well, the whole of Jerusalem was a little bit out of place then, and I dare say it's not entirely not out of place now. But that's a different ballgame. Yes, they were not among the brave, courageous, pioneering new Jews of the kibbutzim and moshavim and the coastal plain. No, Jerusalem was a Jewish shtetl in the mountains. Academics, intellectuals, world reformers, and great, great debaters. And they talked day and night, and everybody wrote novels, studies, family histories, or just letters to the editor. Everybody, the whole of Jerusalem, sat every night writing.
It sounds wonderful. And yet you say it was that Jerusalem at the time was a shtetl in some ways.
Well, wonderful in one way and horrible in another, because let us not forget they lived in between two nightmares. There was the subdued realization of what was happening to the rest of their families in Europe while they were in Jerusalem in the 1940s, when the entire East European Jewish tribe was being murdered systematically. And there was the other nightmare, never discussed in front of the child, that the same might happen to us in Jerusalem very soon as the British administration pulls out and we will be left alone facing a hostile ocean of extremist Arabs. And that will be the next Holocaust. So they never spoke about this in front of the child, but I grew under this cloud of uncertainty.
Did you really feel that doom, or did the people around you feel that they were going to be obliterated by the Arabs around you?
The air was full of fear and insecurity. It was a violent time. There were clashes between Jewish militant organizations and the British administration. There was tension between Jews and Arabs. There was a ferocious British ban on Jewish immigration into the country. There was a struggle of Holocaust survival to swim their way into the country despite the British embargo. All of this turned me into a hyper-political little child. I was a newspaper reader at the age of 7 or 8 and a political and military commentator at the age of 9. I was poisoned by an overdose of history. I'm a product of being exposed to an overdose of history at a very young age.
And it's worth pointing out that your life more or less corresponds with the life of modern Israel. You were born in 1939, and of course the 40s were a very momentous decade in the history of Israel. And then the State of Israel is declared in 1948. War follows shortly after that. I mean, that was all part of your childhood.
I am an Israeli of 65, and being my age in Israel is the equivalent of being a 364-year-old American. You are speaking to a sage. Talk to me with great respect, because I knew personally the George Washington and Abraham Lincoln of Israel. I saw the Boston Tea Party of Israel with my own eyes. I am older than my country.
Was this scary for you to grow up in all of this, particularly once war broke out?
Well, it was many things. It was exciting. War always excites a little boy who has not enough imagination to know what it means until this boy happens to see the first bleeding dead body. Yes, it was exciting. It was scary. It was awful. And at the same time, in a sense, there was a still small voice in me who kept saying, don't forget this. One day you have to tell this story. One day you have to write about this. In fact, it was a kind of message from my parents, from my grandparents. You have to be the witness. Open your eyes, look carefully, absorb everything. You will have to bear the testimony.
You write about one of your mother's friends who was killed by a shell when she went outside to get the laundry. And I guess at another point, your pet turtle was cut in half by shrapnel.
Yes. And I remember the awesome realization that dawned on me that very same night to the sound of the exploding shells all around us, that I too am going to die one day. My little pet turtle had an armor. He was plated. That did not save it and his life. If he, with his armor, died, then I am going to die one day.
Now, there's another piece of this that you write about it as well. I mean, you, as a small boy at that time, imagined you were a great general or a soldier who would marshal your forces to defeat the enemy.
This is not spatial. Every Israeli, big and small, runs the country inside his or her head. We are a nation of 6.5 million citizens, 6.5 million prime ministers, prophets, and messiahs, everyone with his or her personal formula for immediate redemption. And as a little boy, I was one of those. I ran the war inside my own head. I had maps. I conducted battles on the mattress. Furthermore, I tried to win over ancient battles which the Jews have lost 2 millennia earlier. The battle for Jerusalem, where the Romans defeated the Jews, I tried to reintroduce it on the mat with my toy soldiers and win it for the Jewish people, which is what I still do when I write a novel. I am trying to give a second chance to that which will never have it a second chance. This is what my storytelling is really about.
You know, for me as an American, it's almost impossible to grasp this kind of history that you're describing, just to feel this weight of history and how it intrudes on everyday life. Certainly the way you describe your time of growing up in the 1940s, and I would guess for many Israelis there still today, there is this sense that the politics is just everywhere present in your daily life. Has this overwhelmed you at times?
It's a very mixed blessing. I know that for most people in America and in many other countries, history is something that occurs on the other side of the television screen. Not for us Israelis. History is part of everyone's very personal experience, and sometimes history is the cause of one's heavy losses, personal losses. So we have had a scorching contact with Lady History. You know, I have a fantasy, not a dream, but a fantasy. I hope one day Israel will be totally removed from the front pages of all the newspapers and all the newsreels. I am ambitious for Israel. I want for Israel to occupy, settle, and annex the literary supplements, the architecture supplements, the music supplements, the sports supplements. But for God's sake, away from the front pages, we have been there long enough, too long. We have had it up to here.
Now, I have to ask you about the current political situation in Israel. You have been a prominent liberal over the years. You've been a longtime advocate of a two-state solution. What would you like to see the Israeli prime minister do, and what would you like to see the leader of the Palestinian Authority do? I mean, what kinds of dramatic statements or actions could they make?
I think both Israel and Palestine need urgently a more imaginative leadership, a more courageous leadership, a more compassionate leadership. It will be very good if an Israeli prime minister will address himself or herself to the Palestinian National Assembly and talk about the suffering and the ordeal and the unhappiness of the Palestinian people, and promise that Israel will do whatever it can, short of committing suicide, but whatever it can, to enable the Palestinians to have everything we Israelis have, a country, a government, independence, and a relative prosperity. It will be very good for a Palestinian leader to finally pronounce the words, "This land is also the one and only homeland of the Jews, national homeland of the Jews, just as it is the one and only homeland of the Palestinians." This I still have to hear from a Palestinian leader. Those emotional gestures could change the atmosphere and create a certain emotional momentum which will make the painful sacrifices on both sides and the painful concessions easier for both sides.
Israeli novelist Amos Oz talking with Steve Paulson. Oz's memoir is called A Tale of Love and Darkness.